The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
This question we talked about a little bit last time, and it's basically, I think it was the subject of your homework, or very similar, right? Didn't you write a homework similar to this? So we don't have to. You should know, of course, that the answer is no. And it's not just an exercise in power. Of course, the very fact that it's rape means it's an exercise in power in itself, but it's to say that it's not about sex would be wrong. It probably is a sort of an outlier type adaptation to passing genes on. And that's not just based on studies of humans. It's based on the way it occurs in animal groups. It occurs in many primate groups. It does not occur in all species, especially the more complicated, larger species, especially the apes and monkeys, you will find it. So, the question here about, I didn't write it out here, but it's worth spending a little bit of time. He says, imagine that someone establishes that the maternal drive in women is on the average greater than the paternal drive of men across most societies. Of course, you have to translate that. He's talking about drive. That's something internal, right? It's not all that easy to measure the strength of a drive, but you can judge by behavior how they spend their time. Percentage of time they spend with children, the amount of time that a child spends with one parent or the other parent, what they do with them, and so forth. It's very common in human societies to have specialization here. The women do certain things with the children, especially when they're younger. They have the most of the time, and the men don't have much when they're older. The boys will spend much more time with the father just simply because they're being trained to hunt, being trained to fight, use weapons, and so forth. We're talking about hunter-gatherer tribes. So there are some overgeneralizations built into the way this is stated here. But then he goes on. You don't really have to imagine someone establishing that, because there's a lot of data that actually support that. But then he goes on, he says, imagine that an adaptationist, meaning a sociobiologist concerned with social behavior like this, proposes that this results because in past environments, men took both time and energy from paternal activities. Men that took time and energy from paternal activities and allocated them to the acquisition of mates gained fitness as a result, whereas women who did the same lost fitness relative to those who invested more into maternal care of their offspring. And then he asks, I mean, that's a typical type of sociobiologist hypothesis. And then he says, is the sociobiologist being irresponsible by making such a statement? Because people could misuse it. They could use it to justify, you know, keeping women in the home and this and that. You guys are less familiar with the fierceness of the arguments and things that went on in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s of the last century on this point. But what's your answer to that? Is it irresponsible? Am I being irresponsible to teach you these kinds of things? I guess you should know my answer by now. You know. But how would you state it briefly? How would you give me an answer to that? I want you to be able to do that. When you have a class like this, these things will come up sometimes with your families and so forth, with your friends and your other studies. And the fierceness of opposition to adaptationist thinking, to evolutionary thinking about human abilities as opposed to animals, is still very great, you know, in many groups of people. And you may be surprised at how strong it is. My guess is it's more in older people, less in younger people. On the other hand, how do I know that a lot of the kids that dropped out of the class did so because they didn't like that way of dealing with human nature? I don't know. I don't think so, though. That's not why MIT students drop classes. I just met one of them today. He just signed. I had to sign his drop form because he was so late. He came to the first class or something like that. He's working 70 hours a week in addition to doing classes. So naturally, I signed it. But anyway, scientific activity is not about what ought to be, what should be. It's about what is and why it is. Why is it that way? What is our nature? How do we explain it? Why do we explain that we have certain tendencies? And I particularly like the statements there on page 215. I mentioned Dawkins last time, who said, "My own philosophy of life begins with an explicit rejection of Darwinism as a normative principle for living, even while I extol it as the explanatory principle for life." The explanatory principle, but it doesn't guide his morality. And George Williams, who was a great evolutionist and he played a major role in the development of sociobiology, put it in a very emphatic way. He said, "With what other than condemnation is a person with any moral sense to respond to a system in which the ultimate purpose in life is to be better than your neighbor at getting genes into future generations?" And then he pointed out that parasitic organisms that cause disease are beautifully adapted in ways that benefit their genes while causing immense distress and pain to their victims. If more people realized how our naturally selected brain acts in the service of our genes, then perhaps they would be less inclined to endure the consequences of natural selection. A blind process that cares not a whit about human beings or anything else. So in this last chapter, which is fun to read because he summarizes a lot of things that he's gone over in the book, he has this really nice summary of major arguments in the book, especially the argument about genetic determinism. That's only part of those paragraphs. But I wanted you to be able to comment on this sentence there in I think the first paragraph. It's on page 217. Second paragraph. He says, people could not study genetically determined behavior even if they wanted to, because it does not exist. And I did a double take on that, because Alcock has convinced himself that there's no genetically determined behavior, that all behavior is shaped by environment and genetics. And we know that how the genes work, they code for proteins, the organism assembles, including the brain, But it always does so in the environment of the womb initially, and then later the external environment, and a lot of learning is often interleaved with the genes. Often what we inherit is a tendency to learn certain kinds of things more than others, to pay attention to certain kinds of things, not others. But I still find this much too extreme. And I'll tell you why. Because some behaviors have very little variation attributable to learning or other environmental influences. Little variation from one member of the species to the other. Even in human behavior, look at sneezing. I mean, sneezing is so similar, or yawning. There are slight differences that people develop, I'll admit. Especially when you look at it and when it first occurs in children, it's nearly identical, okay? There are, in fact, inherited variations in these things, but still not really environmental, it's still genetic. You'd say the same for walking patterns. People do walk slightly differently, and you can identify people by their walk. There are learned components to that, for sure, but there's also the inherited components are so much greater. Even the differences, one person to the other, are often inherited. Okay. But take the most extreme things, like in humans, some of these very simple eye blink, sneezing, so forth, withdrawal reflexes. I mean, to me, this is genetically determined behavior. I think we don't have to he's coming up with this statement because he's defending sociobiology against the critics. But remember, what they're saying is that sociobiology is claiming that you've got to find a gene for every behavior and this and that. That's not how it works. Every behavior pattern, even if it's largely genetically influenced in its development, is still going to depend on many genes. Why? Well, because what are the genes encoding for that affects behavior? They're encoding for the nervous system. And the nervous system takes a lot of genes. Just to put together one neuron takes a huge number of genes. What other examples, if you go outside of humans? Look at mouse grooming. That's been well studied by John Fentress at Dalhousie University. And you see slight genetic variations in that, but within one strain of mouse, the grooming is pretty much identical from one mouse to the next. And it's truly a fixed action pattern. They don't even need much feedback while they're doing it. Remember I mentioned once that if they're missing a limb, they'll still, the remainder part of the limb will go through the grooming exercises. That even includes things like the limb brushing the face, and even if there's no hand there, they'll still do it in the air. You know? To me, that's genetically determined behavior. Even without feedback, they're still doing it. But anyway, there's many other examples. We read about the geese and the jackdaws. You know that many of those behavior patterns are pretty much the same from one member of the species to another. That sounds like an imprecise statement when I say pretty much the same, but I mean, for all practical purposes, they are the same, you know. And many insects, too, have many, many behavior patterns that are fixed. It's not that they're all inflexible and rigidly determined. He's pointed that out in the book. Okay. Critics of sociobiology like to argue about fitness-reducing behaviors. And I just wanted to remind you about that because one of the early things that was a focus of sociobiology was altruism, which can be appear to be a fitness-reducing behavior, but the studies have consistently shown that most altruism is adaptive, fitness-enhancing, either directly or indirectly. Directly if you're directly helping relatives, indirectly if you're setting an example which will be reciprocated later on. Let's put it this way, is likely to be reciprocated. If you have the reputation of being a helpful person, you're more likely to be helped when you're in trouble.
Can you think of a behavior that's generally thought of as being a genuine example of altruism? Some people, you know, say it's scary and say it doesn't exist.
No, there are many, many examples of altruism in social, in all the social animals, or animals and humans especially. You know, why do we give to charity? Nobody requires us to give to a charity. Why do we do it? You know. Okay, but why do we have guilt? Why do we have that ability to feel guilty? See, that's part of what sociobiologists are interested in. You can say, well, we're altruistic because we'd feel guilty if we don't. But that's not the point. The point is we are altruistic, at least some of us. And probably all altruistic to some degree with some people, especially with our families. Okay, so we talked about, remember, some maladaptive altruism. So how do sociobiologists deal with maladaptive altruism? There are people, for example, who will choose to adopt a child rather than have a child of their own, even though they could have a child of their own. Now, if they're adopting a relative because it's important in the family, that's not maladaptive altruism. Okay? But when a group of Americans get on an airplane and travel over to China to pick up adopted daughters, which they do pretty regularly, and if they're doing that when they actually could have children of their own or be helping people in their family instead, then the sociobiologist would tend to call that maladaptive altruism. What are the potential explanations? There's two that he reminds us of in this last chapter that he mentioned earlier in the book. And we're just doing the fitness-reducing behaviors. One he calls the byproduct hypothesis. And the other he calls the novel environment hypothesis. And you should understand what those two things are. Byproduct hypothesis means that the behavior underlying the behavior occurs because it's a byproduct of something that has evolved that's generally adaptive in its evolution. But along with that, certain other things might tend to occur at a higher than zero probability. So they're byproducts of the adaptive behavior. Like we inherit proximate mechanisms that make us respond to children differently than the way we respond to adults. We even respond to juvenile animals differently than we respond to adults because they look cute, cuddly, this and that. They have short legs, they have pudgy faces, pudgy bodies, and isn't that cute? But what is cuteness? Why do we respond that way to these features? When you think about it, you know, if a Martian from outer space that didn't grow up in our environment and grew up with totally different body structures, they probably wouldn't respond to children as being cuter than adults. But that's evolved. And that could lead to, it gives us a drive to want to take care, to protect, and so forth. We might not be quite as nice to somebody else's kids as we are to our own, but in fact, we will be protective and so forth, even with somebody we don't know. That's the byproduct hypothesis. What's the novel environment hypothesis? That means that the only reason that behavior occurs is because it evolved in a different environment. And now the environment's different, so the behavior appears to be less or even maladaptive now, but it wasn't originally. And one of the biggest problems of sociobiologists and evolutionary psychologists, in fact, is to try to figure out as much as possible about the environment in which humans evolve. That's why paleontology is so important, the field of sociobiology. You know, where did early humans live? What kind of environment did they live in? How many of them were there, etc.? What kind of animals were they faced with? All this. Okay, so that's mainly what I'm after there. Now, we've dealt with this a little bit before, too. Why have many social scientists and people in the humanities ignored sociobiology? Alcock points out that evolutionary biology is alien and disquieting to many social scientists. He calls them social scientists. Some people would say even neuroscientists are social scientists, at least those of us dealing with higher functions, including some psychologists and cultural anthropologists. We've talked about cultural anthropology before, but it's true for some psychologists as well. As well as many philosophers and academicians in the humanities. And then he points out that the real cost of the continuing attacks on sociobiology, which continue even today, is that people in those fields have an easy excuse to ignore sociobiology and not try to incorporate it in their disciplines. And also, I think they confuse ultimate and proximate hypotheses all the time. We've seen that in many places in the book. We even saw it in the Scott book. You know, people confuse them. So he says the people that are suffering the most from these attacks are these people in humanities and social sciences that would benefit by adding this as a new dimension to their science, because it would help them explain things that, in fact, they can't explain very well. It won't help them come up with new proximate mechanisms. And some of them feel that that's their only business, you see, so they're not in. They think that this is a field that wants to take over their field. They couldn't be more wrong. That's not what it's about. But people look at the statements that appeared in Edward E. O. Wilson's book, where he talks about incorporating these other fields within sociobiology. They look at it as this kind of academic imperialism. Biology will take over everything, you know, take over the world soon. That isn't the way Edward Wilson meant it at all. If you've ever met him, you would know what I mean. You'd talk to him. He was simply saying that this gives a new view of these other fields too, and would benefit them. People prefer, Alcock says, to retain a worldview that is familiar and comfortable. And he points out, to illustrate the type of attacks you get, he has this attack on a primatologist at a meeting that I liked especially because it points out what people have to deal with. His name is Craig Stanford. He was at a seminar or a meeting As a primatologist interested in behavioral variation among chimpanzee populations. And he was told at that meeting, in no uncertain terms, not to apply the word culture to chimpanzees. And he was told, apes are mere animals. People alone possess culture, and only culture, not biology, not evolution, can explain humanity. You see, they're very explicit and extreme about their views. Rejecting biology, which, you know, maybe to people at MIT seems pretty ridiculous, but that is what you can be faced with if you try to cross the boundaries of disciplines, you know, and try to introduce this new discipline into another field. Because people can be extreme in their environmentalism. And militant, in fact. And they hate it when you... They said you're lowering the view of human nature if you bring animals into it at all. I always point out to people, when, and I'm accused of this a lot, I say, no, it's not that I have a lower view of humans. I have a higher view of animals than you have. That's the difference. You know? And I can give them plenty of evidence that chimpanzees have culture. They pass things on. Not just chimps, but other of the great apes, and even some in some monkey societies. Like the rhesus in Japan, the snow monkeys that pass on ways of getting food and water, shelling them. Only certain groups of monkeys do that, even though they're the same species as others that don't do it. It's because they learn it. They pass it on to their children or their offspring, if you don't like me to say children of monkeys and apes. Okay. So what are the causes? Let's say a little more about this. Causes of the extreme environmentalism in America. And it's more extreme in America than Europe. Now, I've talked about the educational systems and so forth. I think we can say a lot more about that. We could say that in America, from the very beginning, there was a lot of opposition to European aristocratic society with its elitism based on inheritance. Here we had different kinds of ideals, and it led to the development of democracy, which initially was not as all-inclusive a democracy as we think of now. That came with the evolution of the Constitution and continued with the, I would say it's still continuing, although in the 1960s and 70s we made a lot more strides in that. But the ideals of democracy included the belief that we are all equal. I mean, how many of you have not heard such a term? We are all equal. You know, what does that mean when it's so blatantly untrue? You know? It should mean, of course, equal under the law. That's the way the laws are. They should apply equally to everybody. Okay? But people are more extreme than that in the way they feel about it. It's taken to mean we are equal at birth. Everything's possible for everyone that has the will and finds the opportunity. I mean, how many times have you heard that in your upbringing? More than once? Twice? I would say about 100 times at least. You know, I've heard that in the school system, parents, other kids, and so forth. And it was applied, as I pointed out, to the education system and the development of the education system in this country. And it has had very good benefits, even though it was wrong about, in its extreme form, about human nature. We pointed out that in Europe, the traditions were different. They not only were more used to aristocracies and inherited differences in wealth and I don't think they've all accepted that they were so different in abilities, but maybe some of them did. But they also had a different tradition within science, the development of zoology, as we pointed out. Whereas animal behavior in America stressed environmentalism, learning. Learning was almost the exclusive topic of study in American comparative psychology, which meant usually comparing animals to humans, because their only goal really was to explain human behavior. That's changed now, because now I would say the European ethology and the American comparative psychology have pretty much merged in all the textbooks you read now. You will see that, but the textbooks I learned from were not like that. I had to read different books produced in England and in Germany and in America, and they talked about totally different things. It's amazing. And then certain people started to come around trying to synthesize them. It was so obvious to a young student like me that there's something wrong here, you know. But took a while to figure out just what was behind it all. So I've just summarized for you some of the things I think were behind it. Okay. Okay, what about, I don't know if you've read these questions or not. This guy, Ian Tattersall, was another critic of sociobiology. And he uses this example of how women in a surviving hunter-gatherer tribe breastfeed their infants for 4 or more years, and that if they do that, ovulation is blocked during that time, so they don't get pregnant. And then he concludes that their genes hardly seem to be screaming out for replication, and economic considerations, as virtually always, he says, lie to the fore. For hunters and gatherers, then, it's fertility, not its lack, that is the enemy. He was talking about San women. Individual San women show no sign, conscious or unconscious, of wishing to maximize their output of progeny. Now that's a major weakness of sociobiology, he claims. Is that right?
Nope.
Remember what we said about the advantages of spacing children. It's not just our current economic considerations. You find this across many societies. There's a lot of evidence that it's a tendency that we inherit. It may not be as strong a tendency as other things. There's a lot of variation in it. But the fact is, there are fitness advantages to spacing children, because it doesn't help just to have offspring if they're not going to survive, right? And to get them to survive, what are the advantages of breastfeeding? What are the fitness-enhancing advantages of spacing offspring and of other advantages of breastfeeding? Well, we talked about spacing. What are the other advantages of breastfeeding that enhance
the pet? Child is healthier if they breastfeed as opposed to...
Child is healthier. Why?
There's amino factors in a mother's breast milk.
The right combination of amino acids and availability of energy. It's a high sugar content
and
in breast milk.
And
the immune thing, yeah. He doesn't mention in the book, but you're right. That's good evidence for that.
I think there's some elements of bonding through nursing.
It's interesting that the bonding goes both ways. Bonding of the mother with the child and the child with the mother. And there's other effects on the mother. The mother suckling is pacified, so she tends to be less angry with the child if he's suckling. Societies where breastfeeding goes on for years, sometimes you will see kids that have already reached their teens will start suckling when they're upset because the parents are angry at them. This has been found by certain cultural anthropologists. And you see some of that if you're interested in that kind of thing. There's a lot about it in Ibel Ibisfeld's book called Human Ethology.